This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballaman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike Ballaman, and this is London FinTech Podcast, episode 65, brought to you in association with Smart Pension, Synchron, and Archover. I'm delighted to welcome Lord Turner to the show. Normally, it's fairly straightforward choosing a topic. Guests tend not to have toiled many coal faces deep underground, many mines. However, to briefly run through Lord Turner's CV, he worked at BP, Chase Manhattan, McKinsey, was a Director General of the CBI, the UK's major business lobbying group, Vice Chairman of Merrill Lynch Europe, Chairman of the Government Pensions Commission, Chairman of the Low Pay Commission, Chairman of the Committee on Climate Change, oh yes, and Chairman of the FSA, the UK's financial regulator, as was, from 2008 until its abolition in 2013. An academic and author of several books, the latest of which, Between Debt and the Devil, Money, Credit and Fixing Global Finance, we will touch on later in the show. It certainly is for me a welcome and very overdue focus on not just the way in which banks create money, but what happens to it next and why that matters. Adair is currently chairman of the Institute for New Economic Thinking. Lots of coal faces, lots of mines. If Ipswich has a more successful son, I don't know of them. So how to draw all that together? Listeners to the show will know my predilection for zooming out, drilling up, not down. Everything exists in a context. We live in a context of culture and society. FS and fintech are activities which are very much social constructs. They've differed massively across time and space. The context of my 30-plus years in the city might be summarised as a story of how deregulation led to hyperregulation. I started pre-Big Bang in an FS system that had, in essence, served the empire pretty well for a couple of centuries. Then, quotes, suddenly, unquotes, that all changed. To pick out a few milestones, a bit later we had the Basel I Accord, then a regulator, the TSA. What happened to the governor's eyebrows? Then another Basel Accord, then another regulator, and another. Then dividends on pensions became taxable, all sorts of European currency systems came and went, culminating in the euro. And the biggest crisis for decades and decades, 2008, when the whole system teetered on the edge of collapse. And in those so-called free market Anglo-Saxon countries, nationalisation of big FS players. Are all these things acts of God? Well, for anyone in FS or fintech, they might as well be, with the proviso that tablets of stone appearing ex nihilo are sometimes open for consultation. However, once they're in stone, they're as binding as the rules of football or Formula One. We all have to play within them, and rules ultimately lead to behaviour. To take a current example, Zopa has clearly looked at the rule books and decided to become, somewhat, a bank. So the question for Adair today is, where does all this come from? Where does policy come from? What are the roles of academics, bankers, lobbying groups, politicians, government regulators? Do the people ever get a look in, for example, in the context of trade unions in business boards? How does this metagame, this game of setting the rules for the games, work? Or not, as the case may be, given recent macroeconomic and financial history? Plenty to talk about, so let's get on with the show. Hi, Adair. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you for inviting me. It's good to be here.
You were saying before that actually there are several sons that came from Ipswich that achieved worldwide recognition or certainly UK-wide recognition.
Well, either recognition or a form of infamy. I think one of the most notable people to come from Ipswich was Cardinal Wolsey, the Lord Chancellor at the time of Henry VIII. Many people may well know him from the great Orson Welles representation of him in the film A Man for All Seasons.
So you had a role model.
I don't know whether I've taken Cardinal Wolsey as a model. No.
I like the word infamy. I was just trying to remember talking of films. What that quote, infamy, infamy, she's got it infamy. It was probably some carry-on film, actually. Talking of interesting things, I've quoted you a number of times, perhaps, on the show, particularly as having made some statement or a few words which have stuck in my mind and society's mind for some time, in that some time ago you gave a talk which received lots of attention because it, you know, was really poking the Anglo-Saxons through the sort of bars with a cattle prod, as it were, and you used the phrase socially useless trading, which caused lots of controversy. Now, the controversy at the time I thought was somewhat dull, actually, because I thought it was an interesting concept, but what I never saw that phrase taken was, going back to zooming up, was zooming up. Yes, of course there's lots of socially useless trading and there's actually lots of socially useless accounting and there's lots of socially useless lawyering and socially useless politicking. What was the context of you talking about socially useless trading and can that concept not be broadened out to actually what everybody's doing in society and in London today? How much of it is socially useful?
I think that's a very good point. I mean, the context of that comment was back in summer 2009, and it was a sort of roundtable interview discussion with several people for Prospect magazine, a rather small circulation, a highbrow magazine, which managed to, I think, get more publicity for that statement than for anything else it's ever done. What I was referring to there really was that extraordinary proliferation which occurred before 2008, of those complex alphabet soup of structured credits, CDOs, CDO squared, CPDOs, etc., which when you look back on them, you say, well, did human society need that? I mean, if in the middle of 2008 we managed to lose the instructions to make a CDO squared, would we be worse off? And I was trying to simply say, there are some activities that the financial system can create that really we don't need. They don't make the allocation of capital more efficient.
With hindsight, I think it should have gone further. I think this clearly have been proven to have been socially dangerous trading.
I think that's the crucial point, because the point you made earlier is, well, what about some law? What about accounting? It's absolutely true to say that if you look at it, many of the activities in a sort of rich developed societies are in a sense zero sum. Now, I've got nothing against divorce lawyers. I mean,
you obviously haven't been divorced. I've been divorced and I've got something against them.
Some of my friends are divorce lawyers. But it's quite clear that if more and more clever people, forever cleverer, became divorce lawyers, society wouldn't get better off because there'd be a cleverer lawyer on both sides. The game is a zero-sum context. It's not increasing the size of the economic cake. And we can't avoid that, and we shouldn't disparage that. Quite a lot of what goes on in a society doesn't, as it were, produce new goods and services. It's contractual relationships and debates about who gets what. I think what is different in finance, and it's the point you just made, is in finance it can actually be not just neutral, but actually negative. When you have dealing activity, it's not just like two guys going off to play poker in a pub together, and one of them is going to win and one of them is going to lose, but the rest of society can say nothing to do with me. There's something about if this is done by large financial institutions at the center of the global financial system, and if they get it wrong and create too much risks, it's not just not positive, it can be seriously negative. And I think that's what's different about finance from some of those other sectors of the economy.
Absolutely, and we'll touch on that in the last section of the podcast on your book, because there have been a lot of books written about 2008 and all that kind of stuff. And again, as I've commented on the podcast before, quite often a lot of these gloss over the nature of money. Now, the reason it's not two chaps playing poker is that actually what happens to money per se does affect us all, because all of our economic activity is mediated by money. So moving on from that, as I say, in the big picture, just in terms of my 30 odd years working, things change. It's a bit like you're playing football and the rules radically change one decade to the next. Then you find yourself playing a different game. And scratching my head and getting splinters in my fingers and trying to think of some original conversation, I've never actually really seen much, I mean, other than, you know, old books about the anatomy of power in the UK and elsewhere, that really discuss where all these acts of God come from. And one of the things we're going to sort of touch on in the middle of this is that you spent several years when you were at the FSA trying to stick the world back together and making Basel III in airless rooms in Basel. I was about to say in Zurich. It'd be rather strange to have a Basel Accord from Zurich. But let's go back to the big picture as a whole. So let's go back to quite a long way. So go back to 1985 when I joined the city, having been the tech startup in Bath beforehand. I joined just before this thing called Big Bang, and there was this idea of deregulating.
Yep.
So presumably, and again, this relates to, I think, what you're trying to do with your book, which is inject memes, inject ideas into, yep, into the thought process, into the sort of consciousness. Presumably, at some point, and this may be decades before, I don't know when the first academic wrote about privatising British Telecom or privatising telecoms or something like that. So where do you think this whole process starts? I mean, does it start with sort of academics and clever people coming up with ideas?
You're onto something very important here. There's a very complex interplay between ideas, political interests and arguments, and simply objectives, circumstances, change. So if you go back to the 1930s, there clearly is, both in the US and in continental Europe, there's a crisis of capitalism. For whatever reasons, this system that we thought was going to work produces mass unemployment. And in response to that, there are a group of people who think out new ideas, above all John Maynard Keynes. But there is also the fact that ultimately, the way that we got out of that mess in the 1930s ultimately was the Second World War. It was ultimately the Second World War. If you look at the US, by 1937, 38, the New Deal is only half working. There are still a lot of Americans unemployed, and it's basically US rearmament and war that drives the success.
There's been an unfortunate parallel at the moment, actually.
Absolutely. I mean, one of our worries around the world is, do we know how to get out of our current economic malaise other than fighting wars?
Just on that point, I've seen this sort of non-stop war process in, you know, half the Middle East described as military Keynesianism. It's massive expenditure on military, which then goes and sort of...
I think if military Keynesianism is the only way to do Keynesianism, that is really tragic for the world. And we might come back to that. But going back to your point about ideas, a group of ideas, Keynesian ideas, other ideas, develop in response to the crisis of capital in the 30s. Then we have the war, and the point about a war is you have to have a large role for the state. So we come out of the Second World War with a whole load of people who've been involved in central planning processes. So we move into the 40s and 50s with a lot of people thinking that the natural way of running society is to have a large role for the state. It comes out of the failure of free market capitalism, the ideas of Keynes, but also the experience of the war. It just seems absolutely natural to people that you ration or regulate things. And so that, you know, produces the 1950s. But then a group of people, and there is a conscious element of it, start saying, yes, but there are disadvantages of planned economies. And that is people like, in different ways, Karl Popper, Friedrich von Hayek, Milton Friedman. And yes, they do overtly get together at a place called the Mont Pelerin Society. And they say, we want to push the pendulum back more to free markets. But I don't think that would have occurred just as a result of ideas if it hadn't been from the experience of the 1960s and 70s. Because what happens in the 1960s and 70s is the very fact that we've got planned economies and that we've got a large role for the state and that we've got powerful trade unions, for a variety of reasons, produces an inflationary crisis. I mean, this mixed economy planned system worked very well for about 25 years, but it then itself produces high inflation, the problems of the 1970s in the UK, you know, the three-day week, etc. And that then creates the space for Margaret Thatcher to say, no, you know, I'm going to do something different. We've got to put a stop to this. And at that stage, there's a body of ideas sitting there that says, this is what you do. Now, I think we then took the pendulum too far the other way. We went in for deregulation that produced another crisis. 2008 was a crisis of a deregulated globalized system in the same way that the 1970s was a crisis of, as it were, the mixed economy and trade union power and state power taken too far.
Absolutely. So I subscribe to everything you say. I think the core of what you're saying here, and I entirely agree, is that you've got some thinking which arises, for the sake of argument, keeping it simple, out of one crisis or out of one system. And that sort of thinking resides certainly in the old days in sort of, you know, in academia, and people write papers and they have meetings and they discuss it and they're having a jolly good time. And in a sense, ironically, of course, they, in those days especially, they were paid by the state to do that. But that kind of sits round a bit like a seed cast onto sort of unfertile ground until the idea mates with circumstances.
Yep.
The two then come together, yep, and the offspring of that is then, of course, something which sets in chain a whole another set of processes going forwards. And I was just wondering, but the time doesn't fit into this nice simple hypothesis. So you're slightly older than me, but not massively. My perception of the 50s, which I think went up until about 1964 or something, and I always think what's called the 60s was roughly 65 to 74.
Starts after Christine Keeler.
Yes, exactly. Well, I think it was more the sort of, you know, the hippies.
The hippies.
LSD, yeah, and marijuana.
It gets going in the 1963.
There's a whole social movement where people basically say, oh, bollocks to that. You know, we're dropping out and tuning in and, you know, and all this kind of stuff. And going back as far as Nietzsche, you know, and his sort of ideas, he kept changing his mind about Greek tragedy. But the Apollonian versus the Dionysian, and this comes very much back to sort of regulation, which is you've got this world which is ordered and structured and you've got rules and all that kind of stuff, versus the kind of, hey, let's forget all the rules and let it all hang out. And you've got these sort of the tension, this dialectic, as it were, between these two things, which swings backwards and forwards. And most of the people listening to this show will be rather younger than you or I, and won't remember three-day weeks, dead bodies piled up, having to wait 6 months to get a mortgage in the 70s, having to wait 6 months to get another telephone line, and all that kind of stuff. So the deregulation was a logical consequence of that. Then, as you say, fast-forwarding the story slightly, we get to where we are at the moment. In the meantime, though, there's obviously been some kind of selling of ideas. I mean, you're involved in this with your book at the moment and your ideas of monetized finance. We'll come on to later. So there's been a kind of selling ideas, and there's been a sort of receptivity comes along at some point, and some people with power or the need to solve something take them up. And then there's this thing called the political will to do it. How do you see historically this thing about political will? Is that literally something that comes out of circumstances?
I think it comes out of circumstances. Let's take the UK. And actually, it's quite interesting. There were two waves of this. Ted Heath originally came in 1970 with a very strongly free market agenda. There was a thing which really many of your listeners will not know about. There was a thing called Selsdon Man.
I live around the corner from Selsdon Park Hotel.
The Selsdon Park Hotel. A group of Tory thinkers got together there in 1968 or 69, and they drew up a manifesto which in 1970 was seen as sort of radically free market, and we were going to build an economy around Selsdon Man. Now, what happened is that when they began to hit what we'd think today of as relatively low levels of unemployment in 1972, they just jumped that and they went back to over rapid fiscal expansion, etc. But the idea had been there before. I think what then happened is that, I mean, I was at university in the 1970s. I had an absolutely wonderful time myself, but it was a fairly stressful time in the British political and economic system. I mean, it is, I think, amazing to young listeners who haven't studied the history to know that for a time we had inflation of 20%, we had interest rates
15%.
Of 15%, we had strikes that went on forever, we had this mass picketing environment where people would try and stop other people going for work. There was just a huge debate going on about how we ought to order our society. The Labour Party actually, in relation to the trade unions, it's an interesting story, had tried to suggest a sort of moderate reform of that back in 1968, but had been defeated by its own left wing. And we ended up with a sort of sense of crisis by 1979, at the end of the Callaghan government, and that was the opportunity for Margaret Thatcher. I don't think she would have had the opportunity to put in place what was a still more radical proposal than Ted Heath had if it hadn't been for the fact that people felt that the existing system was just failing. But when she did that, there was a whole body of ideas which was developed. I mean, I remember being a student at Cambridge. I was involved actually in conservative politics then. I was chairman of the Conservative Association. I'm now a crossbench peer. But I got invited down in 1975 to the early stages of what is called the Centre for Policy Studies, which was then run by Sir Keith Joseph. And this was a group of people sharing ideas about free markets, which were seen within the British context as radical, but which drew on the thinking of people like Friedman and Hayek, and to a lesser degree, because he's a more centrist figure, Karl Popper. And so when Maggie Thatcher came in, she had, as it were, an intellectual guru, Keith Richard Joseph, who had
a theory, a model.
A model. And he had introduced her to Friedrich von Hayek and Milton Friedman, and so she was aware that there was a model out there. So there's a wonderful phrase from John Maynard Keynes that practical men who believe themselves completely devoid of theory are usually the slaves of some defunct economist, that actually ideas matter, that the crystallization of ideas into distinct, well-thought-out theories provides politicians with an intellectual lodestar, but they need the opportunity as well. If Margaret Thatcher had attempted to stand for election with her program in 1964...
She'd have been crucified.
She wouldn't exist in history because the objective circumstances did not allow her to be elected at that time.
So that's very eloquent, and I think I totally buy in the model, and I'm sure most people listening will buy most of it. We will fast forward in a little minute to where we are at the moment, because the corollary of that is that if you want to see where we are in 5 years' time or 10 years' time in FS and in fintech, then we really need to be examining the ideas that are around at the moment, the ideas, as it were, the seeds that have been cast around that actually aren't growing into rainforests. Not the rainforests grow from seeds, and we're chopping down rainforests, but going back to your green hat, but that's another thing entirely. So let's just narrow into the finance then. So how I see regulation as having gone over the period, my prejudices slash experience, is that I started in financial services when there was a regulation of structure. You had merchant banks, you had stockbrokers, you had clearing banks. Glass-Steagall in the States as well. And then basically because, keeping it simple, because globalization sort of kept happening a bit more, everyone says, oh, this is a bit unfair. Japanese banks are trashing us because they don't have any capital whatsoever and most of its equities. So we've got to have a bit more of a level playing field.
Yeah.
So then Basel I came in, which was kind of the first approach at global banking regulation.
Yep.
And again, younger listeners may not realise that there was a day when actually the UK regulated its banks in its own way.
Yep.
Germany did its own banks
absolutely.
In its own way.
Absolutely.
And Japan did its own banks yep. in its own way. So this was, quotes, a good thing, or quotes, it was necessary, it was a force of circumstances. And it was a pretty simple rule, which is that, I mean, just simplifying, of course, which is that, oh, of course, sovereigns are risk-free, we all know that.
Yep. Yep.
And everything else, well, let's just call it 8% or 12%, I can't remember the number.
Mortgages were 50%, yeah. Banks were 20%, companies were 100%, roughly.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And then the capital yeah. ratio was 8 or 12, So oh, that's all quite fine. So, you know, that lasts for a while. Then, of course, what happens is that people start arbitraging the rules and all that kind yeah. of stuff. And, you know, the money flows where the rules of the game dictate. And then we get sort of Basel II. And then I don't know where this kind of comes from, but maybe nothing should go wrong in society kind of vibe. So regulators get sort of bigger and bigger and try and control things more and more and more. And then we get 2008. And I'd be interested to hear your story after 2008. And then we've got things like Basel III, where we've got this massively detailed regulation. And you know, one of the quotes that I just sort of love was from Niall Ferguson, who in his 2012 Reith lecture came up with a statement which is that he believes that excessively complex regulation is the disease of which it purports to be the cure. Andy Haldane, who I've got a lot of time for, although yep. I've taken his poster off my wall ever since he was talking about getting rid of cash, he wrote this great paper called The Dog and the Frisbee, and there are not many things that I've read on risk this millennium that I've actually liked, and that was a very good one. For the sake of yep. argument, the executive summary is you can't manage complexity with complexity. So yep. we've gone through this period of regulation of structure, which going back to something like football, football's got simple rules, so kids can play in the playground. Formula One has got very complex rules, so everyone ends up arbitraging the rules and you get a sort of very dull game. So we went from regulation of structure, which was a good thing. Iceland has gone back to regulation of structure with narrow banking, which, as far as I'm concerned, is the only way out. We then get globalised stuff, which is necessary. And then, you know, we've got this sort of Max Weber rationalisation and this sort of polar winter of icy darkness and these massively complex rule books where we've got the engineer of human souls trying to control everything in great detail. And that's actually never really been proven to work either. Well, so how do you see it anyway?
I think our most fundamental problem in the financial services is that we have over-leveraged banks. Banking sort of developed organically, and only slowly did we develop, you know, a theory of how you respond to it. And the crucial thing to understand about banks is banks do not do what a lot of the textbooks suggest they do, which is to take pre-existing money and then to lend it on to somebody else. By the process of lending money, they actually create money that did not previously exist. Now, that's difficult to see if you're a small bank, a cog in the system. But if you look at the total banking system, it's absolutely obvious that in aggregate, they create money that didn't previously exist. Indeed, all our money essentially comes from two things. It either comes from the private sector banking creates process of creating money, or it becomes because the state prints money. And it turns out that both of these are potentially problematic processes that you need to focus on. So banks create credit money and purchasing power. And actually, we haven't focused enough in economics and as regulators of, yeah, but how much of it do we want them to create? And I think what happened is, because we never went back to those basics, we kept on trying to say, well, it must be a good idea for them to create money, credit. That will lubricate society. We didn't really ask questions about whether there could be too much debt, whether there could be too much credit. And so what we did, and I think Basel II was particularly the bit where we went off the rails, we began to believe that we could get banks themselves to do incredibly complicated analyses of the risks that we were running. And we failed to realize that the most important risks that banks create are not what they individually do, it's what the totality of the system does. And that will never be captured by any bank itself, however capable and however much it cares about what it's doing, trying to think about the risks to itself. The risks are to the system. The risks derive from too much leverage and too much money in the system. Now, the only way to control this, I believe, is for us to have banks much less leveraged. I spent 4 years of my life in windowless rooms in Basel, debating Basel III. And I was a hawk, along with colleagues in particular from Switzerland and the US, and we were arguing with colleagues from elsewhere in the world about whether we should have the capital ratios for banks at 7% or 7.5%. We argued in a sort of trench warfare about each 0.5%. If I were a benevolent dictator of a world economy being set up for the first place, I'd just say banks should have 20% of their loans in equity. And if we did that, we'd actually be able to get rid of a lot of the rest of supervision and of regulation, because you'd have so much equity that in almost all states of the world, you could be confident that the only people who were going to lose were the equity owners for whom the executive and non-directors are responsible. And they'd be fundamentally answering to the equity directors. And if they went and lost that 20% equity, they'd be fired, but it wouldn't be a problem for the rest of society. The way I think about it, what we have done with the banking system, we have allowed history to create a sort of truck heading down a motorway, and the truck has faulty brakes. It doesn't have enough capital, and the crash barriers aren't very good. And to make up for that fundamental structural deficiency, we've crowded a whole load of supervisors into the driving cab to look over the driver's shoulder and say, well, go this way, go that way. But we should aim, and I therefore entirely agree with Neil Ferguson and with Andy Haldane, we should aim for much simpler regulation, and the core of it should be much more capital. And interestingly, other colleagues of mine, I'm thinking, for instance, you know, Philip Hildebrand, who was then at the Swiss National Bank, now at BlackRock. I remember Philip saying to me a couple of years afterwards, he said, if we were to do it all over again, we'd really just say it's capital, capital, capital. And everything else is a bit of a diversion. And sometimes a diversion which gets in the way of seeing where we want to head.
Absolutely. Well, let's try and unpack that. There's quite a lot there, and it's very convincing, and let's fold in some of the things that you're talking about in the book. And then we will come back to what stands in the way of, as it were, rational, intelligent men with experience actually putting in place simple rules that would work. And I think that's a question of power and the fact we live in a corporatocracy and all that kind of stuff. But let's come back to that. I think in terms of, you know, one of the things that you haven't had the chance to say that's implicit, and having watched a few YouTubes of your talks recently, I was fascinated myself, actually, I wasn't aware of this, which is that the structure of lending and that macroeconomic models, which most of the people who I follow rather poo-poo. I'm a big fan of Yanis Varoufakis, for example, who has clear ideas, and the Korean chap whose name I can never remember, 23 things wrong with capitalism.
Hao-Jun Chang.
Thank you. Your Korean pronunciation is rather better than mine. But in the macroeconomic models, the sort of the details of bank lending are sort of kind of omitted, as is a lot of the banking system in a sense, because you've just got this thing called an interest rate that you sort of feed into your mathematical model. And in one way, actually, I think, you know, in a sense, one of the things that you're trying to do at a much deeper level than most other commentators is answer the question that Queen put to the LSE, which is, how come none of you
saw it coming?
But coming back to one of the important things I think that people need to understand to have more sympathy with where you're coming from, which is that if you look at the structure of bank lending, then I think on your sort of fag packet, which is probably a rude way of putting it, but on your crude calculation, because the number's quite hard to get to, of bank lending in the UK pre-crash or whenever it was, the vast majority was against pre-existing assets, financing a competition, I was about to say, between you and I for houses. You're probably not competing with me for a house. Probably use my house for the garage. But real estate lending, pushing up property prices, which even before deregulation of Big Bang was always the problem in UK banking, the unstable property sector. And that, in terms of productive economy, which is another one of the myths that, you know, banks lend money to businesses and that's really important to keep it all going, yada, 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 it was as little as 15% of bank lending went into lending to businesses. Now, there's a separate argument which says, do businesses these days need as much capital as when they were sort of, you know, building steel plants and all
that?
Put that to one side. Yeah. However, it clearly, to any sane person, does matter, going back to your point about in the aggregate, what the aggregate of bank lending is. If, for the sake of argument, let's just take an extreme case, bank lending ends up being a sort of 100% to property loans and nothing else, all we ever do is bid up the property market, which we've done already. The worst thing that politics and the system has done in my lifetime is put property prices through the roof, so my kids are going to struggle, and goodness knows what my grandchildren are going to do to get on the property ladder. The average first-time buyer in London is 40. If you're a teacher, forget it. Yep. You're never going to own property. So this point about the aggregate bank lend is absolutely essential. And then I think one then got to address well, how have we got into that situation? And coming back to the rules of the game, I think then it comes back to the politicians and the rules around what property can be built on. And I think it's something like, I saw Dominic Frisbee once talking on the interweb on YouTube, and he was saying something like 1% of land on in the UK has got residential property on, 2%, no, 4% or something has got gardens or 2%, and 4% roads or something like that. But actually, it's a piddly amount. So going back to your point, which I agree entirely, which is that the wise engineer of society wants to put in simple, clear rules to address the super big picture.
Yep.
How does one address that kind of stuff? And again, not many people are talking about that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think what I've done in my book is go back to these fundamentals of what does the banking system does. And I think there's two things to understand about the banking system. One, it can create new credit, new money and purchasing power. So it matters what it lends it against. And the vast majority of what it lends it against is real estate. That's not the fault of the banking system. That's not the fault of people running banks. That's where the demand is. Because, first, as you said, there are many businesses today in this software digital world that don't need as much money to build factories as used to be the case. I mean, pure private investment is actually falling as a percent of GDP. And secondly, modern economies are real estate intensive. I mean, a large percentage of the wealth resides in real estate, and it's bound to do so. And the richer we get, the more that location matters. Once people get rich and they've got as many washing machines and clothes as they want, one of the most obvious things for them to spend their money on is making sure that they live in the nice part of town or the bit of the countryside which has a garden or, you know, close to the nice schools. Completely natural process. And there is a role for the banking system in that. There is a role for lending money to people who haven't, you know, inherited a house or inherited enough cash to lubricate the interchange of these housing and commercial real estate assets between different people. And there's a process of lending money to developers and house builders who develop new stuff. But we have to realize that while that is, you know, up to a point, a socially useful function, it's also something which, unless we offset with strong regulations which are lean the other way, has a huge capacity to run out of control. You will never be able to design, for instance, a regulation which distinguishes between lending against real estate development and lending against existing real estate, because a lot of development takes existing real estate and then plays around with it and develops it a bit, and the lending is simultaneously financing the development but also potentially financing a change in the value of the underlying land. So one has to be very wary of believing that you can dive into this and be precise. And that's why you have to lean against it by simply saying, we're going to have limits on loan to value. We're going to have limits on capital requirements. What you're also right to say is, of course, the fundamental problem derives from the interface between a limitless capacity of the banking system to create credit purchasing power, and the fact that the supply of locationally desirable land is in limited supply. Now, I agree with you that there are some things we can do about that. I think in particular we can make it easy to develop on brownfield land. I think in our cities we could go further up. I'm a little bit wary in a relatively densely populated country of saying, well, let's just build everywhere, because the reason we don't build everywhere is also a perfectly naturally arising response of people to saying, well, you know, it's got to the stage where I worry about, you know, the school playing fields disappearing into another housing development.
We end up like in Star Wars where the whole planet is covered in concrete.
So we don't want that. So we've got to manage this by enough sensible planning rules that make the supply of new housing or commercial real estate as elastic as possible. One of the important things here is you need to develop cities so that as many areas within the city as possible are pleasant, well-connected places to live. Because if everybody's trying to get to a particular bit of the city, because that's the pleasant part, then you are going to drive the real estate boom and bust. The starting point of sanity here is to realize the fundamental problem we face. Modern economies will be real estate intensive. Banks can create credit, money, and purchasing power. Banks left to themselves will migrate to property lending, not their fault. All businesses migrate to where the demand is. We need to understand that that is the process and that that has some benefits and risks. And then we need to lean against those risks with a small number of powerful regulations rather than micro-supervision.
Absolutely. And this does relate to fintech because, I mean, the last episode with Peter Renton, talking about Lendit Europe 2016, as well as China and America, and we were talking about your talk there. And one of the interesting things I was saying, we didn't really have time to go into it, but which is that at the moment, because the FCA is still in the process of regulating or not regulating or approving or not approving all the P2Ps, they're being incredibly cautious about what they say in public. But in private, they've got lots of crazy ideas, as always, of course, which they don't dare say. And a lot of those are ironically around real estate. So I think we need to get going back to this big picture of what is the process that leads from idea to new policy, yep, to new sort of tablet of God. Where do these sort of rules come from that mean that Zopa decides, oh, do you know what? After a dozen years, we're going to become a bank, obviously, because they feel that those are the rules that they need. And I agree with everything you've said, but I think there's the dimension we've missed out, which is the dimension of politics and the dimension of power. And I don't believe we live in socialism or capitalism at all. There's a bugger all capitalism going around. I mean, a little bit of it in fintech. I believe, as I said before, that actually we're much closer to what Mussolini defined as fascism, which is the collaboration of the state and the corporate. And coming back to the real estate prices in the UK, which are a nightmare, I'm reminded of the definition of a politician or a government as people who use your own money to bribe you. And there's been a great impact over our lifetimes of everybody feeling wealthier because property prices are going up. So there's that kind of challenge with politics. But also you've then got this whole lobbying issue, which is that power, as Varoufakis says, is increasingly moving from the political to the economic. And the economic is increasingly influencing politicians. Obama originally stood for, you know, coming down hard on Wall Street. He got the greatest campaign contributions ever from Wall Street. And then I was watching John Pilger interviewing Assange recently. I do these things every now and then to find out what's going on in the world rather than the BBC's propaganda. I didn't do it too much because I just end up getting depressed. And apart from a sort of thing which I hadn't heard of in the mainstream, which is that there's the biggest concentration of troops on Russia's borders since 1941, which is not so good. They were saying that actually when Obama got elected the first time around, Citibank sent him some list of suggestions, shall we say, for the cabinet, most of which were followed. President Carter has said, I saw him on YouTube talking about this, which is that the US is run by oligarchs. So putting the US to one side, or UK or whatever, we've got this situation where power resides in corporates. Corporates have got increasing amounts of power. Between the corporate and the politicians, it can be increasingly hard for, quotes, the rational policy to sort of work its way in there. Vested interests.
I think there is a difference here between the US and some other political regimes, including the UK. I think in the US, the sheer power of money politics is that there is an army of lobbyists in DC. They have huge influence with individual congresspeople and individual senators. If you look at the members of each of the relevant committees, you will find that they are given huge campaign contributions by people who are effectively overseen by that committee. And I think you have a very explicit process, for instance, in the next steps of trade regulations, whereby when you have something like TTP or TTIP, the government does listen to what business wants in a very precise way. I think it's subtly different in the UK because our backbenchers are just not that powerful and our committees are not just that powerful. They just can't do as much. And so although there is lobbying and influence, it's much more difficult to say that rule happened because of that lobbying by that group of people. And I think we do have a better, cleaner system in that respect. The other thing I would say is don't underestimate just the power of inertia in systems. So I was involved for 4.5 years of my life in 2008 to 2013 in the re-regulation of the global financial system. I was chair of the major policy committee of the Financial Stability Board, which along with the Basel Committee really designed the new regulation. And I and various sort of allies on the process would have liked higher capital requirements. I have to tell you though that our biggest problems in getting those were not the lobbyists. I mean, we did have, you know, Jamie Dimon of JP Morgan saying, oh, they're overdoing it. We did have lobbying sometimes going into the US. I had one or two discussions with very senior US politicians who were expressing points of view which clearly expressed the lobbying on them. But actually, the biggest problems of all were some of my other colleagues who said, oh, nobody dare, we can't do that because it's going to depress the economy, because if you have higher capital requirements, there'll be less lending to the economy. And at the moment, we haven't got any other tools available. And that was true of the Japanese and the French and the German colleagues. And so it was a sort of don't start from here problem. Almost all of them would have agreed that if you could start all over again, you might have much higher capital requirements, but they were stuck within the existing system. So inertia has a huge effect. One of the difficulties once you've got a mistaken system is you're stuck with that system. And all you seem to be able to do is micro changes from it, unless there's a cataclysm like the 1930s or the Second World War, in which entirely new structures emerge. And I think one of the problems we had after 2008, bluntly, was it was bad, but because we'd got better tools to offset it, it wasn't bad enough that it made us move to an completely new approach. We thought we could get away with incrementalizing from the existing process. So I think that's as important, at least outside the US, as pure money-driven business lobbying to explain why we still probably haven't done radical enough things to fix the financial system for the future.
Well, that's very interesting, and I love your stories about the practical example of Basel III, which is the way that banks are regulated around the world and actually how it works in reality. And we're going to come back to this in a minute, because really what you're talking about, we're listening to you there, I was thinking of various incarnations when I've been wearing a sales hat or a marketing hat. Yeah. And for a salesman, the biggest adversary is always the status quo, yeah. Which is, no, I hear what you say, and you know, the world isn't quite perfect at the moment, and you've got some good points, and what you're saying is quite good. But you know, it kind of is what it is.
Yeah.
Could we change it? So let's come back to that. But before wrapping up the show and talking about how we get over the inertia and how we affect change and talking about your book, I'd like to thank the listeners out there. Without the listeners, there'd be little point doing this. There's thousands of you and it's increasing all the time, and I'm very grateful. I'd also like to thank my brand partners for the podcast, Archover, smart, simple and transparent P2P business lending. Loans up to £3 million for SMEs, delivering up to 7% secured and insured returns to lenders. Smart Pension, who are fast, secure and free. Check out their UK workplace pensions at autoenrollment.co.uk. Synchron, digital, business consulting and technology services for top-tier FS. From startup to 6,000 people, 16 countries and $400 million of revenue. So picking up this point there about how we actually change things and picking up this example of memes and ideas and your book, which the FT called A Wide-Ranging Overdue Challenge to a Financial Taboo, you quite rightly differentiate, of course, between the different political and lobbying systems in various countries. Also, as you've said many times, and we're all aware, the UK is pretty much a small island and it's sort of open these days and all that kind of stuff. I read an article yesterday when I was doing a little bit of research for this, I think it was 2011 or something, by The Telegraph, which was saying, oh, you know, Adair Turner's a sort of a shoo-in for the Governor of the Bank of England. There's this Canadian chap, but there's no way he's coming. You know, if tomorrow you get made the Governor of the Bank of England, or tomorrow you get made the Chancellor of the Exchequer, having had this time to step away from it and think of it from a big picture, as you say, there's always the problem, which is actually where we are is not the best place to start this journey from. And I entirely agree that we've got to cut back on the money somehow, whether we go the whole way and do it like as positive money says, or go back to gold or something like that. But clearly the system's out of control at the moment in terms of this private creation of credit, which for which everything else tends to span. And I entirely agree, we're on the same hymn sheet here, that having a billion micro-regulations isn't the way to control a sort of lorry out of the thing. If you were made global fascist dictator for the day tomorrow, you could actually implement this, because you'd wave your magic wand and you make sure every country did it at the same time. You know, monetizing finance, which we haven't sort of talked about, 20% bank capital, and then actually everyone's on the level playing field, and then we go forward. One of the reasons we were talking about earlier, which is why good ideas don't get implemented, is just the practicality.
Yeah, absolutely. I've come out in my book with a set of fairly radical ideas. I argue for a much tighter regulation of bank capital, for instance, a 20% capital ratio. But I also say, because we didn't have that in the past and other faults, we've got far too much debt in the world. We're not going to get out of this debt simply by growing our way out. And I made the equally radical suggestion that there are some circumstances in which governments have to write off existing public debt, which is essentially called monetizing debt, which essentially means you've paid for a fiscal deficit with printed money. Now, two different groups of people are shocked by both of these ideas. One group of people is, oh my God, you know, Adair's this sort of crazy sort of German credit hater who wants 20% capital ratios for banks, or Adair's this mad sort of socialist inflationist who wants, you know, to print money and spend it. Of course, those ideas that you should more tightly constrain bank credit creation, but that under some circumstances it is appropriate to use the state to create nominal demand, actually their intellectual lineage is Milton Friedman, Henry Simons, Irving Fisher, all absolutely sound money free marketeers, who back in the 30s and 40s thought far more deeply about the inherent nature of money and credit creation than most modern economics. And, you know, if I was the, as it were, benevolent dictator of the world economy, and if I were the dictator, I'd be a benevolent
Absolutely,
one.
Absolutely, yes.
You know, I think you would go for a coordinated across all countries fiscal expansion lubricated by permanent central bank money creation, which would involve writing off some of the existing public debt. You'd place that within very tight limits by giving to trusted independent central banks the authority to say how much of that you're allowed to do and no more. And you would simultaneously, you know, very significantly increase the capital requirements of the banking system. And you would offset by the stimulus of money financed fiscal deficits the transitional impact of moving from too low to reasonable capital requirements of banks. That is what you would do. Now, you ask me what I would do if I was governor of the Bank of England or Chancellor of the Exchequer. I would almost certainly do nothing, anything like that radical, because when you are in one of those jobs, you are constrained by the fact that you're part of a global world where you can't get everybody else to coordinate. You're constrained by the fact that markets might take fright from you saying radical things. So all you can do in those circumstances, and you mustn't disparage this, is move a bit closer to the optimal, right? Which is easier to do if you have a vision of what the optimal is. So if I was governor of the Bank of England, would I stand up on the next day and say, I now recommend that the government...
I've read this very good book that I wrote last night.
I've read this very good book by my prior self, and we should monetize the debt and have... You know, no, I wouldn't. But would you be signalling that the direction of change on capital requirements should be continued to be up? Yes. And would you be signalling that it's wrong to say that faced with deflation, we ever run out of ammunition, and that there are other tools available, tools about which I've written in my book, which Ben Bernanke has spoken about, and that people should take assurance from the fact that those tools, including monetization, are available if necessary. Yes, I think you could do that as well. But there is always going to be a difference. There's a great essay written by journalist, international politics historian, thinker, Timothy Garton-Ash, which is a conversation between him and Václav Havel, the president of the Czech Republic. And the subject matter is, can you be a public intellectual who provides ideas, but also a person doing a government job? The resolution is, you can do them at different stages in your life, but they are different things. The provision of ideas will always be a different thing. Once you are in an actual role of government, you are constrained by the reality, the situation that you inherit, and it therefore is sort of facile to attack politicians for not, you know, immediately describing their completely radical plan to go from A to B. They can't, but the better politicians at least have some idea of what the better solution ideally would be, and it at least pushes the direction of change somewhat in that direction.
In terms of they can't, I think, as you were saying, starting with the Second World War, I've forgotten who it is now, but someone said 2008 was a good crisis gone to waste, because it's only when there's some huge crisis can you make significant changes rather than just tacking in the right direction. Anyway, time has absolutely shot by, and thank you very much for that, Adair. It's been a fascinating conversation, and I'm quite sure that it's given listeners insight into levels of policy creation, policy implementation, that they wouldn't have got otherwise. I made the mistake of watching a few of your YouTubes on Monday morning when I was, you know, didn't have enough coffee so the brain wasn't really engaged, but then I watched some on Monday afternoon when I was a little bit more awake. I'll link to some in the show notes, but I do think that the thoughtful listener would really enjoy some of your challenging thinking on these matters. A lot of it is actually self-evidently true. There's no real argument against it. And in terms of the fintech world, I think the fintech world at best has been a bit like the sort of the hippie era where 1,000 flowers are blooming, and not to mix it all up, and people are actually trying to do stuff in a different way, which at the margin will be more stable. I think my sort of slight sadness at the moment, having started with Zopa, is that a lot of them want to go back to the old world, but that's another thing entirely. And I very much recommend your book, and I wish you every success in the future, whether the future holds either or both of ideas, lobbying, I'm talking about three things now, it's not either or both of, or actually going back to rules where you're implementing stuff, because I think, we haven't touched on this, but you know, a lot of your stuff around climate change, around inequality, around low pay and around pensions, this stuff can sound incredibly abstract, but let's not forget this stuff affects everybody's life in the world. And a lot of people in this world do not have the quality of life that you and I are fortunate to have. And so this stuff really matters. So thank you very much indeed for your time, and good luck with your future.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe on iTunes or your podcast app, or sign up at londonfintechpodcast.com for email alerts and new episodes. Live long and prosper.
We could sit in a bender all day, watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. Come away from the city, with the tarmac so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city, with the faces so grey, with the pain of the the mountains and the trees. Can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. City goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me. 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 Watch the firelight dance.